Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker, I'm the Head of Public Engagement. This is a podcast about objects and our relationship with them through the lens of the Chow Chak Wing Museum's remarkable collections. One of the research areas that the museum is very excited about is inviting visual artists into the collections to respond to the collections and various objects within it. The current exhibition in our Penelope Gallery is called Penelope and the Seahorse, and it's by Sydney-trained and Melbourne-based artist Michaela Dwyer. This recording for the podcast is from a public event held in early March where Michaela was interviewed by Dr. Tony Ross, the curator. You'll hear my colleague, Dr. Ann Stevens, introducing both of them.
I'd like to welcome you all. My name's Ann Stevens. I'm the Senior Curator of Art here at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora land, on whose land we work and play. And there are two tiny fish hooks just in that case, on the front of that case, which come from the Sydney language group. And they're one of the very few material cultural remains of that original Sydney people. So they're very precious to us. But back to why we're here today. The Penelope Gallery opened a couple of years back. We've had four artists work on installations. The first artist was Daniel Boyd, who did a wonderful pediment in pediment. And there's the central element of his exhibition is out on this level on the bridge. That's indigenising the Acropolis. The second artist was Sarah Goffman, who made a magnificent chinoiserie mimicry of many works in our collection. The third and most recent were Dee and Kate Harding, which was a show that Hannah Matthews curated from Monash. And if you're not familiar with Dee's work, there's some magnificent examples along Eastern Avenue at the City Road end, which was commissioned 2018. But today we're very, very privileged to have one of our own, Michaela Dwyer, here today, who sadly works now in Melbourne at RMIT, where she's Professor of Art. But for many of you, you would have known her either at the University of Western Sydney or here, or not quite here, but in Roselle at SCA. So we're incredibly delighted to have you come to the Chow Chak Wing and do the installation. And I'm personally very in debt to Tony Ross, who when I was away stepped into the brink and worked with Michaela to curate this Penelope and the Seahorse. Many of you would also know Tony, who is now honorary senior lecturer at the Faculty of Arts, Design and Architecture, Sydney, but also you would probably know her as the Sydney Reviewer for Art Forum. So we're delighted to have you as the interlocutor with Michaela. I think that's probably all I have to say, other than after their conversation, I'd encourage you, if you haven't already been at the installation, to visit Penelope and the Seahorse on level two. If you could welcome Michaela and Tony, they're going to come up and talk here. Thank you very much.
So just before we start the conversation, which I think will be more of a Q&A, as I have a huge list of questions for Michaela, and I think it's best if she does most of the talking. But I want to make a slight disclaimer about the curating title. I contributed a small amount to this show. I did some research and wrote some copy for it, but it was really a joint effort with the wonderful staff here, Katrina Liberiu and Luke Parker, and Anne too participated, so they did a great job. So to start, Michaela.
I just want to say thanks to that lot too. Yes, it takes a village.
Okay, so it's called Penelope and the Seahorse, which sounds a little like the title of a children's book, but, well, there's a lot more going on than that. And I know that one of the initial ideas was to work off the word hippocampus, which is the genus name of the seahorse. Apparently its origins come from the ancient Greek, and it's a compound term meaning horse plus sea monster. But the show isn't just about the seahorse, hippocampus. There's references to the hippocampus, which is a structure in the brain, in the mammalian brain. So not just humans have two hippocampi, but other mammals do, I think. And also there are references to mythologies of the ancient world with some fabulous artifacts from the Nicholson Museum, referencing those mythologies from ancient Greek and Roman culture. But I want to start with the seahorse, hopefully not get bogged down with the seahorse. But so what stimulated your interest in this unusual fish?
I think in the beginning days talking with Anne, we were talking about all sorts of things marine, like the all the sands around the coast of Australia was in the collection, and we just sort of started on the geology department. It's a feast of wonders in Sydney University, and part of the joy of being invited to show here is that you are invited also to consider the various collections and play with them. And just, you know, Anne and I have a long relationship, and she's one of those fabulous curators that lets you meander in your thinking. And so we started with sand and rocks, and then we ended up with a seahorse. And I think the seahorse came out of, I think there's a marine scientist here sort of researching, in particular the Sydney seahorse that has been on the edge of extinction. And so that got me thinking, because I've been doing a series of work on animals, objections, so possums, pigeons, koalas, and now the seahorse. I collaborate with a friend in Melbourne. She's an amazing animator, Gina Moore. So the seahorse kind of took hold, and it's because it is such a weird creature, and the male gives birth to the babies, amongst many other strange traits it has. And it was a starting point, but it then went kind of off on another tangent. But also, I'd just like to invite you to, if you want to interrupt at any point and ask questions, I really think it's better to ask questions when they're in your head rather than letting them breeze till the end, then we might not have time at the end. But if you want to interrupt, I love being interrupted. So anyway, that was the starting point.
Okay, and I think you've been quoted in some of the publicity as saying that the seahorse has great symbolic resonance. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of that.
Yeah, I think the seahorse has, I think it kind of has a sense of magic and symbolic resonance, because it has that, you know, long history and a sort of vaguely mythological character that is, you know, sea monster. It also was the horses of the sea were the ones that carried Poseidon's chariot through the oceans, and Poseidon sort of then came in as another character in this installation, and Poseidon is also known as Earthshaker. So there's lots of, I guess, thinking around the mythologies, and the seahorse has a sort of presence across many mythologies. And
I mean, I've read recently that one of the most recent symbolisations of the seahorse is a feminist one. Yeah. So it's become a feminist symbol because it reverses normal animal kingdom reproductive roles. But also it's very popular. This doesn't really come up in the show, but there are hints in the show that the seahorse is perhaps endangered or all that those large chunks of plastic floating around in the space and so on. But I've also read that it's part of traditional Chinese medicine.
Yeah.
And is a popular ingredient in both China and in Japan. And as with a lot of these things, the seahorse can cure a myriad of illnesses. But one of them is it's been described as a form of natural Viagra. So that it's a cure for male impotence.
Yeah.
But also for asthma, heart disease, bedwetting, all of these different things. I just think it's interesting that these qualities are applied to an animal in this way, these capacities. And I just wondered what you thought of that, about that.
Yeah, it's a strange creature. And then again, we name the little parts of the brain, the hippocampi, named after the seahorse because it's a similar shape. And you know, it's the hippocampi, is that bit in the back of the brain. There's two of them, and they're quite, they look quite symmetrical, but they have quite different functions. And they, you know, they kind of do a similar thing with memory and creating fictions, both future fiction and past memories, and spatial mapping and also social mapping. They're quite complex processing parts of the brain. And, I guess this relationship to the seahorse, you know, why we make symbols, why we make, and often why does symmetry sort of play such a strong part in the formation of symbols? And I'm trying to get back to your question.
You don't have to.
Yeah, I think,
So the seahorse is also, it's described as a spirit animal. So there are these sites on the web, sort of New Agey sites. And again, the seahorse, people can adopt seahorses as their spirit animal. And again, the qualities associated with it are so numerous.
Go on.
Yeah. But to get on to the appearance of seahorses in the show, so you've done this, well, a fabulous video with Gina Moore,
mm-hmm.
and also seahorse shapes appear in other works in the show, I think in the paintings. And I just wondered with the video animation, and it has a sound component as well, which it'd be good to speak about, what effect were you looking for in the representation of the seahorses in the video?
It's interesting because there's actually no seahorses in the show.
Not real ones.
It's a phantom of a seahorse. So these two seahorses are completely deep fake, built out of geometry. Sad. It's very sad. Like, you know, they're like an apparition that's come from the future to stand in for seahorses that might be lost. So I guess they're holding a space of loss, in my mind anyway. So they're holding a kind of, you know, the way a ghost would come and visit and, you know, remind you or carry knowledge from one period of time to another, you know, the way cultural knowledge can be passed on through, you know, ancestral spirits and seahorse spirits. What was the question again?
What effects were you looking for? So obviously they're not natural science specimens, or they're not obviously realistic specimens.
Yeah, no, but the sound is actually from actual seahorses.
Yeah.
So the recording is sourced off the internet. So it's gone, you know, I haven't gone out into the field and recorded seahorses, but you can actually find these things. So they're really, you know, I've tried to create an atmosphere that is a combination of interweaving stories of both the site of the Penelope Gallery, and why it's titled Penelope is because It's named after Penelope Seidler, an amazing woman that I have great admiration for, but it's also the name of Penelope in mythology, who wove and unwove her weavings every night as she was waiting for Odysseus and tried to ward off the suitors. She kept saying, I'll marry again when I just finish this cloak or whatever she was working on. But, you know, it was a strategy to buy time. And also, you know, locating it, there's nothing surreal in this show for me. It's very real for me. I'm not trying to evoke something particularly fantastical. I'm trying to sort of create a very real emotion of loss, I guess. So for all its ideas of apparition and things that are intangible, I'm trying to kind of pull that into a very physical and real space and, you know, on site, in the gallery, in relationship to the whole museum, in a sense of the whole memory that is held in artefacts, in the matter of objects in the whole museum across time. Amazing. Like as Anne opened with this Gadigal work, Gadigal artefacts here, you know, the importance of that matter and how it holds memory. So it's sort of talking, trying to sort of talk across all these things. I've gone off on a tangent, sorry.
No, you haven't. So, I mean, it's like really almost like a congregation of memories, I think, history and so on. And not the kind of collecting of memory or history that one would expect in a history book, for example.
Yeah.
It's all mixed up, but it's also beautifully brought together in the end, I think.
Mm.
Just if I could go back briefly to the brain hippocampi. The paintings are made of, well, they're geometric shapes, but rather softened ones, very colourful, almost like a patchwork around them. But the main shapes are two mirroring images of what actually looks like a tadpole to me. But in fact, it is the brain, the shape of the brain hippocampi, which doesn't actually look like a seahorse. I think it's more like a blob at one end and a curled tail, like a seahorse. And in fact, I gather the anatomist in the 16th century, I think, who named the seahorse hippocampus, started with silkworm rather than seahorse, but the seahorse stuck. Yeah. In the end. So back to the painting. And so there's a big circle. There's the creation of a big circle in the middle and the two brain hippocampi shapes on either side. Can you just talk about what you think?
It's also a
there?
Corner.
Yes, it is.
So, I mean, to sort of weave it in with everything else, it's, you know, painting is it's an activity from, I guess, the imagination at from the brain, from the memory, from, you know, I'm trying to weave it all in together so that it you are walking into sort of some actual memory making kind of space or something, so that the painting is like a void in the corner that is, you know, I sort of think of it as a reference back to the anchor, which is the Neptune's trident on the floor, which is, you know, it's a blue circle. It's a void. It's the sort of corner, the centre of the corner there. Or it's a symbol for me. It's a symbol of, say, Neptune floating around in a grid of soft squares and colours that with these wafty kind of hippocampi holding it in play. So it's, you know, grid is another kind of mapping tool that crosses over to the weaving. You know, it's a very loose...
Well, there are connections, so many connections between the works. So I guess looking at them in the singular is perhaps not entirely the right way to go. But as usual in your work, there's a conversation between all of the works. The Seahorse Hotel, which is an upended shopping trolley, hanging suspended from the ceiling, and it looks as though you've crafted a seahorse head or shape out of plastic, and it looks to me as though it's trapped in the trolley.
Or it's trapping the trolley.
Or it's trapping the trolley. And
I think it looks like it's eaten the trolley.
Right, and it's got the Seahorse Hotel sign, neon sign, hanging on it.
Or happy ending sign. Sleazy Seahorse Hotel.
And another component of the show is the vitrine with the selected relics. From the Nicholson Museum, and also some little bronze objects you had made that actually, the way they're crafted, they look like relics you dig up anyway. They're roughly crafted and so on. Can you tell me a bit about the ancient world objects in the vitrine? Why did you choose those particular ones?
I think I was just looking for objects that kind of pulled out more of the connections between symbols and mythologies like Poseidon and the kind of aquatic marine world, that ancient world, sea country.
Yeah.
But playing, I guess, across. So the way that when you put things in a vitrine, they become very erratic and, you know, they're out of your reach and they become like holy relics. But by playing with them in this way, I was trying to pulling them into relationship with other things that aren't so sort of historically precious, perhaps, that you perhaps create something that's less artifact. You know, like I always think, you know, try to liven them up a bit, you know, so that I think we get very bogged down in valuing artifacts to the point in sacrificing a sort of more living way of, you know, using or considering objects. It's a mix. So you've got the Starbucks cups that have the Skilla, the sea monster on it, that's become quite domesticated, as you were saying before. You know, we just had the security guard come over to when we were standing down there to say that we couldn't have those cups up on the Perspex. Very bad and very dangerous. Sort of coffee cup alert.
Yes.
I was with the curator because she could sort of assure him that it was the work.
Yes, it's a wonderful contrast between the Starbucks coffee cup or plastic drink cups with that emblem of Scylla, who's a sea monster from the Odyssey, I think.
Yeah.
Homer's Odyssey. And there's an urn in a funerary urn that was probably one of the larger objects in the vitrine from the collection. It's the most amazingly wild image. It's a woman with octopus legs. It's a relief. And she's wielding this massive oar as though she's going to, you know, decapitate someone.
She probably
and then
was,
you've got the Starbucks emblem on the cup, and it's this pretty little Scylla, you know, with decorative
her legs have been amputated.
Curling up like if you could see ringlets them. And so on. Yeah. So it's a lovely contrast.
So just to, I guess, it show that these symbols carry across time in the weirdest places. That this sort of longevity of symbols is really curious. Like when we're all long gone and dead, like there'll still be symbols floating around.
Yeah.
Or mythologies.
Can you say a little, you mentioned it before, but could you say a little more about the weaving? Which is a found weaving, I gather, is it?
No.
Or you actually?
I've gone to great care in unravelling that. That took me a long time.
and it's all undone at the bottom and falling apart and being unwoven, basically, which was your contribution to the Hessian. I think you painted a little of it as well. But can you just tell us your thoughts about that work?
I think that was just also to locate it back to Penelope, but also as a sense of unbelieving and a seemingly unreasonable action after you've done a whole lot of weaving that you would unravel it, but to buy time. I guess it's to pull something apart is kind of, you know, I guess it's, you know, to create and then to put apart. It's what we do in everything. We build and then we destroy it. And I guess, and I wanted that materiality of the Hessian to kind of tie into the materiality of the cords that hold the plastic, and then, that all the materials are on a sort of equal playing field in some way or shape or form. I'm wondering if anybody wants to ask questions. You know, you might all fall asleep otherwise. Does anybody have any questions? The seahorse was sort of my animal spirit the whole way through, you know, testing me, guiding me, telling me that looked really crap the whole way through, and just not to try and represent a seahorse, copy a seahorse, leave it to my fabulous animator, Gina Moore, because she could do it much better. But I wasn't, I guess the seahorse was just a sort of like a weaving point, you know. It's like the weaving is there as also a model of thinking in terms of trying to not necessarily weaving but unweaving as much as unraveling, as a way of connecting things that aren't necessarily connectable, and trying, the seahorse was there, I guess, as a thread to come in and out of, but also the way it would go into hippocampi and the brain structures and the shapes and then geometry and then the void, extinction, death, loss. Can we die better? You know, like it keep coming back to the seahorse. It's a lot of modelling, though. Okay, underlying it is modelling. It's just my go-to with a lot of things. I'm not a cut. There's two types of artists. There's carvers and there's modellers. I think I can't quite own painting, being a painter. I think of my paintings as sort of somehow built, sculpted. I'm such a bad painter. I just but the modelling of the wax and the clay, and the wax was really difficult because it actually isn't soft and malleable. You've got to heat it up and it sets really fast, and you've got to work fast, and I actually had never done it before, and so there's all these contingencies. But, you know, sometimes I think that the quicker you work with something you don't know, sometimes you capture some kind of animal spirit or something. I don't know, you know, you're thinking about a seahorse, and I was really surprised looking at them when they came out finished that actually some of them looked like seahorses, because I was trying to also sculpt the brain. So it's like this brain hand moment, you know, moment where you're trying to get a shape. It's not really a seahorse. It's not really a bit of the brain, but it's something that will carry a feeling to someone else. So there's a psychic transfer somehow of one thing. So to me, the material, it's about a kind of psychic transfer of materiality. So moving from one to the other, to me, they're all one somehow. They're all like the plastic is like the bronze, like the wax, and the way I work with Gina, you know, we work together. Like there's a sort of modelling of each other's thinking and ideas, and we talk together. I go, no, that's, I don't want it like that. She goes, oh, but, you know, there's a modelling of thinking. So there's modelling, and the materiality is something that is modellable, I guess. Does that make sense?
Okay,
Yeah, I think when you also you're in that mode of making something, you start to work with these objects and you think, oh, someone did the same thing with that. There was a modelling process or a painting or a cut. You know, there's some hand that's there's that sort of transfer that's still resonant all the way to now. It's incredible to be able to work with these objects because they really, you know, I can see why we fetishize them because they are now extraordinary. But also what's extraordinary is just that they've lasted so long. Intensive workshop in Melbourne that we were invited to do a public art proposal with Melbourne City Council and another artist, Sean Lynch from Ireland, and I were invited, and we had this incredible two-week workshop, like really sort of looking at site, city Melbourne, but around these parks, and like talking to Aboriginal elders, talking to scientists, environmental scientists. Like we even got a tour of the Doherty Virology Lab, which was in the area, and philosophers and poets. And also the people were invited to this two-week kind of intensive, which it was a radical new kind of model for public art. Like normally, you know, you get invited to put in a proposal and it's kind of a plonker that comes after a sort of vicious competition. And whereas this one was like they didn't want anything from us for about a year. Like they just gave us all this like food for thought in this intensive and sent us off for a year to kind of think about it and really develop a deep relationship to the site. And, you know, after talking to a lot of people and having sort of conversations with both the environmental scientists and the Aboriginal elders and other stakeholders in this particular park, I sort of ended up gravitating towards, I came up with this really sort of dumb, simple idea after, you know, a lot of time, but I just couldn't shake it, and it was a possum. I just wanted to have a possum in the tree as a projection, which so simple, but it was so complicated, as you know. It was, demanded lots of big lifters and, you know, crews of people and weird, you know, expensive projection units, and a very simple idea got very complicated. It was a public artwork that was only seen sometimes at night. You know, it was quite different. Like there wasn't, it was just something you'd catch out of the corner of your eye. It wasn't in your face. These two projections of possums that would come at night off and on. And it sort of, the information about this work was sort of transferred by kind of gossip or rumour, and often through the Mandarin community, speaking community, which had, we'd sort of set up a kind of gossip chain with through social media, because it was a heavily sort of student. And it was a whole thing about this problem of the possums inhabiting this site and having the trees were dying and trying to move them on. There's a whole lot of possums trying to save them and then environmental scientists trying to cull them. And so that's where it started with these projections and this working with creating animals. It was in lockdown, so I couldn't go and film possums. So I thought, oh, we'll make a possum, which in the end seemed more appropriate. Yeah, so then it became the possums, and then it morphed into a koala, and that was sort of after the bushfires and all the koalas were getting wiped out. So it was sort of about creating these ghosts and these apparitions that would haunt us. And then there's one in Surrey Hills on the corner of Riley and Crown, I think. I think that's where it is. It's on a building, though. It's not a projection. It's an LED. I haven't actually seen it yet myself either. And then there was a pigeon as well, done a pigeon. So they're not necessarily animals that are extinct yet. They're, you know, so it's a sort of play in time, future and
they're not
past.
Traditionally charismatic animals either.
No, I like them.
I do too.
Oh, yeah, so the sound was, you know, I worked it really does take a village, and it always makes better work when you work with other people. So Gina and I work with a composer, James Hayes, down in Melbourne, who always brings something different. You know, like we collaborate together, and we wanted this. We'd worked on a previous work with birds, and this, and it was quite heavily treated, and the soundtrack. Whereas this one, we started work on this, and the sounds are so weird and strange and lovely that we just it's quite naturalist. So there, the sound is the sound of the seahorse when he's, or she and he, I think, are sort of mating or want to mate. And the other sound, there's a sort of a shushy kind of gravelly sound that's the sound when they're stressed. It's sort of like a growling sound. So there's these two sounds that are playing off each other. And it's like, it's a very odd sound. If you, like, I played it over and over again to see whether it would get irritating and people get sick of it. But I just found it really mesmerising. And it had the knock-knock sound has a sort of timbre that is quite otherworldly. It's just not, it could be knocking on wood, but it's not. It's just so, such a special sound. And
what I noticed about the audio, which, as you say, is quite mesmerising and not annoying at all, the growling, and it is described as growling, yeah. I think, in the literature, it actually sounded more like the beating of wings to me. And the knocking, that doesn't sound like knocking, or does it? Maybe it does sound like knocking.
Sort of, it's a funny sound. You can go and listen to it.
Yeah, but it's seahorse vocals, definitely.
Yeah.
I think we might call it a day.
Unless you've got any other generous in your questions. Thank you.
And enjoy the show and drinks.
Drinks on the terrace.
The cafe.
Thank you for listening to Object Matters. Michaela's exhibition, Penelope and the Seahorse, is on display in the Chow Chak Wing Museum until the end of 2023. Object Matters is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of these lands and to pay respect to the elders past and present who have cared for them.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.